Hey, today's show is brought to you by Noble Gold. And with all that's going on with the economy and all that's being hidden that's coming out tells you it's a lot worse. We're just seeing the tip of the iceberg. You really need to protect your assets. And I want to send you to DaveHodgesGold.com, DaveHodgesGold.com, and we'll send you out a complete information packet. Remember, the banks can keep your money under Dodd-Frank 2010. We're not going to let them do it. Let us show you the solution. Cost you nothing to look. DaveHodgesGold.com. And don't forget, every investment carries an inherent risk, and we're required to say that by the FTC. There are no guarantees. I've been a customer of Noble Gold for 7 years, been an advertiser for eight. On to today's show. We are brought to you by from the Noble Gold Studios, Noble Gold. And we're really glad to bring you this information. Listen, you can leave your money in the bank, and when they get desperate, they can take it. The Dodd-Frank Law 2010 says they can do it. It's unconstitutional, but they've made it legal. So what do you want to do? Well, I think you need to diversify. That's what I've done. I've been advertising for Noble Gold for 7 years. I've been a customer for over six. I just rebalanced my portfolio last week with them. Let me give you the same opportunity. I want to send you a free information packet. And I'll have Noble Gold's number in there to explain everything that they do, including protecting your retirement. Go to DaveHodgesGold.com. That's DaveHodgesGold.com. Well, we have one of our most favorite guests that we've ever had on the show because he goes really where no one else goes. And his name is John Thaler. And John has an extensive background in investigating criminals. And the criminals are seemingly everywhere, particularly in the swing states. My state of Arizona, we are a captured operation, and we've uncovered some information regarding finance and the cartels and HSBC Bank and the whole nine yards. And we're going to ask John to sort some of this out for us. John, welcome to the show. I'm really glad you could join us.
Thank
And
you for having me, Dave. I appreciate it.
yeah, well, you've done such good work. You've written, by the way, I want to get to this right away. You've written something called Report to the Governor. Is that publicly available now?
Yes, as a matter of fact, because my publisher makes me do this. This is the book. This is the hardcover version. I like to show people this only because, this is how thick this book is. It's 630 pages. It's about the 4-year investigation that my office conducted into racketeering, bribery, corruption, election fraud, mostly in the state of Arizona, but with the tentacles going out into many other states, including California, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, and then some of the eastern states like Ohio, Pennsylvania. And so, it covers the 4 years of investigation. It covers, what a lot of people know to be my personal story as well, how I got involved in the invest this particular investigation. And it involves the abduction of my then 2-year-old child as a way to try to stop the investigation from continuing.
Wow, that's amazing. How did that end up with the abduction of your child?
It's still an ongoing issue. He is safe, which is the best part. I don't discuss too much about it other than that he and I have not seen each other in now 3.5 years. But the rest of it I don't discuss because it is ongoing. I expect that that situation will relieve itself and will come to a conclusion shortly. But it's been, a tragedy all around. Here's a 2-year-old child. I was his primary caregiver. Really from birth, I was his primary caregiver, who got caught up in a very bad family situation with, in-laws of mine involved directly in the organized crime activities. And, the thought was, is that if we take him and we hold him, we can essentially extort you into stopping the investigation. I'm not one for extortion. I basically can't be extorted, which is, I guess, in some ways why what I do and how my investigations go is so effective, because nobody's going to pay me off. And, unfortunately, McKinley got caught up in the middle of this and to a degree still is.
Right. Now, from our previous interview last year, you indicated that you came across this information as a result of a computer that was left open and you were able to access the files.
It wasn't so much that. It was the origination of this was, was actually fairly innocent. I want to go back a step on that just because you had asked me something before we began that we're going to touch on. I began this actually long, long, long before that particular relationship where McKinley was ever born. This goes back now about 12 years, actually 13 years into 2011 and 2012, when during a series of investigations on Russian organized crime, a blackmail scheme was attempted. Now, I didn't have a child who could be blackmailed then. I have another child, but I didn't have one who could be blackmailed. That wasn't it. But there was a number of swatting attempts that were made on me to try to get me to stop the investigation. And it turned out that the person who had arranged the swatting attempt, now we know the term swatting. In 2012, this was not a common term at all. People didn't understand about, you know, lawfare and calling the police, and making false reports. You know, that wasn't something that people had heard about or knew much about. But that's what happened to me in 2011, 2012, in the middle of this investigation. And it turned out that the person who had prepared a number of the documents to try to, you know, to perform the swatting happened to be Brittany Rae Chavez, who ultimately in 2016 became my wife, Brittany Rae Chavez, now Brittany Rae Thaler. So you know, basically almost 3 years before we ever met face to face, she not only knew who I was, she had already schemed you know, with other people to try to, you know, create confusion and problems in an investigation involving organized crime.
I didn't realize this part of it. So let me take this to its logical conclusion on the face. So she did this from afar, and then she tried to do it up close as your wife?
Well, I think that it's actually a weirder story than that. And it's also maybe in a weird way, you know, in the true sense of the term romantic, it's a much more romantic story than that. She had originally been contracted to prepare a number of falsified documents that were supposed to be presented to a court in Los Angeles, California. And essentially, there were enough problems. You know, look, being a lawyer is not easy. And when you have complicated subject matters, you know, a lot of lawyers screw stuff up. And the problem was is that a number of the documents that were filed with a court in Los Angeles County were screwed up, were not done correctly. And it was not something that a lawyer specializing in, this is an area of real property, of course, it's not an area that a lawyer doing real property would have screwed up. So it was very clear that this was amateur hour in terms of the documents, in terms of what was filed, how it was put together. There's some very esoteric laws in California that were violated in terms of the documents that were you know, drawn. So some stuff that made it very clear that this was a fraud. Who did it and why they did it was not so clear for several years. When I moved from California, I lived in California full time until roughly about 2011. In 2011, when I was living probably the majority of my time in the state of Arizona, in 2014, the set of documents made their way from California to Arizona. And, you know, that happened about 6 months before I met Brittany Chavez. So, you know, what basically had happened was, you know, she was paid to put together the documents. She did. And then when I moved to Arizona, she was paid again to move the documents from California to Arizona. And then, you know, through that process, for whatever the reason, decided that she was going to meet me. And I don't know if that was for the purposes of you know, trying to see what my assets were or trying to see what research I was doing on something. You know, I never know, because with what we do, you know, it's very encrypted. It's very hard to get into. You can't just break into our computers and steal anything. So I don't know what the original purpose was. But I would tell you that what winds up happening is she decides that, you know, maybe she can date me, run off with me, if you will. And what she's going to do is hide behind me, that she's going to get out of the business. You know, as we've talked about before, her family is in the racketeering business. They're especially in the money laundering business. The Chavez, as I call them oftentimes on Twitter, the Chavez crime family are fairly major, you know, operators in you know, what we call cleaners, you know, for organized crime. And they do it certainly for the cartels. They do it for other entities, other businesses. They do it for a lot of real estate, you know, moguls in the state of Arizona. And you know, Brittany had been a part of this and made a part of it since she was about 8 years old. And so I think that Brittany got to a point, you know, as she turned, you know, she got to be about 30, she decided she didn't want to do this anymore, but she needed kind of something she could hide behind. She wanted family. She wanted child. She wanted, you know, what you might call a normal suburban life. And I think that she decided at some point that she could do that with me and she could run away from all this. The problem was, is that, you know, these things, you know, were not small things. And the way she got kind of caught at it, if you will, is that after McKinley was born, which was in December of 2017, I was looking at documents in order to write up a trust for us in case something happened to the two of us. And I came across in the recorder's office, the Maricopa County Recorder's Office, real estate documents with her name on them that clearly she had signed. She had signed them in all different ways, including signing, you know, as Brittany R, middle initial R Chavez. She had signed them as Brittany Chavez. She had signed them as Brittany and, you know, TTNI Chavez. She had signed them as Brittany Chavez, and so on and so forth. And not only that, but it had her on many of these recorded documents as husband and wife with somebody named Justin, middle initial E. Chavez, which I knew she had not been married before. I knew that didn't make any sense. So, you know, one thing led to another. And, you know, you start looking at these things and you realize that these are, you know, falsified documents. You realize that the transactions are falsified. And, you know, my first inclination was that it was tax evasion on the part of her family. I didn't think of this on a big scale thing. I thought that this was tax evasion on the part of her family. And, you know, so I kind of asked her about it because the one thing I didn't want it to do was touch and concern us. We had a child. So you can't just say, oh, I'm going to divorce court tomorrow, or, you know, you're not being truthful with me. We now have a child. And so I started asking questions. I was not getting honest answers. And, you know, over the course of 2018, more and more and more started coming out about these real estate transactions. And ultimately by 2019, you know, Brittany was really breaking down from all of this. She was starting to, you know, kind of, she wouldn't admit directly to all of the fraud, but she was admitting to, yes, that's her name on the document. And yes, this is part of something her family is involved in, and so on and so forth. And it really grew from there. And then, you know, what happened in 2019, as I talked about in the book, is that it went from, you know, just a number of deeds with falsified signatures, with falsified notarizations, you know, obviously money's being placed through properties on phony sale transactions. I mean, that's what it was. But what started to happen too, is we started to find more and more documents that she had been involved with that involved payroll theft, it involved insurance fraud, it involved Medicaid fraud, and the number of things just started piling up. And so through 2019, she kind of became, you know, what you might call a percipient witness. You know, she was questioned a lot by me and by others. She broke down on a lot of it and provided a lot of information, which was what a lot of the investigation was. You know, but by the end of 2019, she was seeking witness protection. She actually went to me and one of my colleagues, John Stanley, and asked for WITSEC, which is federal witness protection. And then shortly before, you know, just as we were making application for her, her family members found out, threatened her toward me with bodily harm toward me. I think even threatened McKinley with, you know, with bodily harm. And at that point, she essentially took McKinley and tried to run off with him, you know, fearing for her life and to a degree fearing for mine. You know, and like I said, the rest is kind of history. You know, the rest, you know, went into the investigation. You know, she provided a great deal of material for it, and certainly the basics of the different areas, you know, such as the bribery, the corruption, the election fraud, you know, all the different racketeering activities, the payroll theft, et cetera. And so, you know, in 2019, you know, we got clients on this who hired us to figure out how bad this really was. And so for a number of companies that hired us, we were able to get into their systems and prove that they had, for example, fake employees on their payroll that they were paying. So that was one aspect of it. We were able to determine that not only did they have fake employees, but the fake employees were taking out insurance policies under the group plan. Then a number of the fake employees were dying, quote unquote, dying, bodies being, quote unquote, cremated, and the proceeds being paid to the, quote unquote, husband who didn't exist. So we had, you know, ripoff after ripoff after ripoff.
Let me tell you about my friend, John Cruz. I first interviewed John about 12 years ago, and he was a naive, promoted rapidly to senior VP of HSBC Bank. And unknowingly, he was put in charge of managing many of their money laundering accounts. After getting roadblocked and fired and roadblocked by the federal government, he eventually got enough information and was going to go public that they assessed a $2 billion fine to HSBC. And he said it was money laundering, boiler rooms, fake identities tied to the Clinton Foundation. And he thought I'd be interested in it because he found evidence of it coming into places like Arizona. Okay. And then he leaves this behind after he wrote a book. And he worked for Allstate Insurance, was managing an insurance company. And he discovered they were selling data to be used for fake IDs.
Yeah.
Does this sound anywhere related to you? Because I thought it might be, and that's why I contacted you.
Yeah, it's not only related to me. I actually have a section in the book about, you know, bank fraud. In the cases that we have worked with, and a case I'm working on now, I'm currently working on a multi-billion dollar insurance and banking fraud matter that involves, well, you know, that involves in some part, not entirely, but involves in some part Wells Fargo Bank. Wells Fargo Bank is also responsible for setting up a lot of the phony accounts that are talked about in the book. But I also have a section on this about the major banks, Bank of America, HSBC, Wells Fargo, Citibank, And I talk about the money laundering cases over the last 15 years or so that they have been charged with and have been fined on, have you know, either pleaded guilty, either criminally or civilly, and the penalties that have been exacted on them for doing it. Banks are in the business of making money. And if banks believe that the penalty, the fine that they'll get is going to be substantially lower than the profits they're going to make and, you know, the number of new clients, new business they bring in, then certainly they're going to take the fine. You know, rarely, and this is the biggest problem, rarely are bank officials prosecuted criminally for these things. So what happens is the bank may be fined, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, but it pales in comparison to what they're really making, you know, all over the world. Yeah. From these operations. That's the biggest problem. But they are all involved in it, and they all do it. And it doesn't take much. In the case that I've been working on lately, you know, involving the insurer and the banking company, you know, this is a medium-sized bank that, you know, colluded with an insurance company to essentially rip off, you know, for probably close to, you know, $1 billion, you know, policyholders, you know, who were put into policies they shouldn't have been into, that they couldn't even understand. You know, there's a lot of financial issues with the deals. There's a lot of IRS violations with the deals. But it's not hard to do. And it doesn't take an entire bank. You know, I think somebody quoted this back to me the other day on Twitter, where I said, you know, you don't need every judge to have corruption. You don't need every city council person to have corruption. You don't need every police officer in a police force to have corruption. If you can get about 5 to 10%, you can corrupt the rest of the operation, especially if you get it at the senior leadership positions. And, you know, with Wells Fargo, for example, this, which has been a big problem, you know, the way they have individual bankers, if you can corrupt an individual banker, you can set up accounts for anybody. You know, if you use the same banker over and over and you slip money to them under the table, you're going to be able to set up hundreds, if not thousands, of accounts. And the banker's going to look like a freaking genius because look at all the business he's brought in.
Right. What John thought was interesting is he discovered that when HSBC paid their $2 billion fine, and by the way, the person who prosecuted this was Loretta Lynch when she was with the Southern Division in New York before she became
Attorney General.
Yeah. Yeah. But he found that HSBC had already set aside the $2 billion before he was even hired to manage these fraudulent accounts. So they were looking at this as this is the cost of doing business. Was that the same true with B of A, Wells Fargo, and the rest?
Yeah. In fact, one of the things that we now look at very carefully, and we're actually having a problem in this multi-billion dollar case, is first things we do is when we go into one of these things is we try to request, usually on behalf, in this case, on behalf of policyholders, where did their checks go? What accounts did their checks go into? How did they get paid? Where is that account located? Where did the money go from there? And what we normally find is two things. One, when they have a specific fraud operation going on, they will segregate the funds so that the rest of the people in the bank, you know, the rest of the banking officials never see the accounts. And the second thing is that they know what the potential penalties are. So, you know, it's kind of like buying insurance, where for every dollar they'll take in, you know, 25 cents, 20 cents, 15 cents is going to go to another segregated account to take care of, you know, fines and issues, lobbying efforts, whatever they need to try to get out from under.
Wow. It's amazing. Well, I want to tie in what's happened. He's been involved in two court cases with Allstate. When he began to ask questions, they fired him. And I told him, I said, it looks like bad luck just follows you. But what he found was these fake IDs were being created based on real people's data and then sold off. Right. And they took him to court to try to silence him. And they haven't been successful. They're trying again. Is this typical of what you found as well?
Well, I'll make it even worse for you. One of the things that we found starting roughly about 2011 is that one of the main sources of data is hospitals. Now, people, you know, think of hospitals with files and with actual pieces of paper. But anybody who's been in a hospital over the last 5 and certainly 10, you know, maybe even 10 years knows that nothing is on paper anymore. The days of a doctor, you know, handwriting on a file are long gone. So files are created and kept digitally in hospitals. When you are in the hospital, the file is there. When you leave the hospital, the file does not stay on their server. There's a period of time by which the data goes off of their server and is then stored in someone else's server. And there are data storage centers throughout the country that basically store things like hospital data. Now, if you think about how many hospitals there are, how many patients are treated, how many urgent care facilities there are, patients treated, how many doctors there are in the country, patients treated, you can just imagine how many files you get. And so one of the things that you have now is you have these storage facilities, one particularly in San Diego, which is particularly egregious, that take in information and then basically, collate that information, use data mining techniques to mine the data and then sell it back out. And if you do it, if you know how to do it, it's very, very hard to detect and very hard to catch. So one of the companies that we've dealt with on this is, in Arizona, is the John C. Lincoln Group, which is, Honor Health. Honor Health, is a fairly big conglomerate of hospitals like Dignity
Huge,
Health.
yeah.
They're huge. John C. Lincoln, one of the things that we found was that one of the senior vice presidents of IT, of course, at the John C. Lincoln Group in Phoenix, and if everybody has seen this, it's right off I-17 and Bell. People can't miss it. They essentially were providing data, filtering out data at that point, at the hospital point, into a separate database where it was then being sold and used to create fake IDs. Because what do you know? Think about it. When you go to the hospital, what do they have? They have your name, your address, your social security number. They have your usually your parents' names, your mother's maiden name, et cetera. All those identifying features. And then from that, you can obviously get a credit report if you need one as well. And they have everything. So the hospitals have been one of the primary sources of stolen data. I mean, it used to be that the way data got stolen from hospitals is, you did everything in triplicate on those carbon forms. And you'd have dumpster diving, late at night dumpster diving into the carbon forms because nobody shredded at hospitals back in those days. So, you could wind up, this actually happened to me. When I was in law school, I received a cut that needed a couple of stitches. I was over at Scripps Hospital, very well-known hospital. About 2 or 3 years later, I get a call from Bank of America that said, they said, "Do you know that you're late on your credit card payment?" And I said, "I don't bank with Bank of America. I don't have a, in those days, Bank America card." And they said, "Yeah, we didn't think you did, but just so you know, your card says you owe about $6,000." I said, "How is that possible?" They said, "Well, we've traced it back to a dumpster dive of a bunch of Nigerian students in San Diego who were working, got jobs at the hospital, cleaning jobs at the hospital. And late at night, they would go into the trash and they would pull out the carbons. And then they would set up fake accounts and fake addresses and, use everything from the carbons." Well, those days are over. This is all now done electronically, and it's quite severe. By the way, that's not the only one. I'll give you another one that we talk about in the book that's really fascinating, is dating services. To consider dating services and all the information you provide them. Now, you generally don't provide them your social security number, but everything else you provide, your name, your address, your height, your weight, your phone number, where you live, where you have lived. I mean, consider something like eHarmony. Which is designed to match people to be married. So it's not like Tinder where you put five things of yourself, half of which probably aren't even true. For something like eHarmony, you're putting down a lot of data about yourself. What's your favorite place? What's the favorite place you've ever traveled to? What was the name of your favorite pet? I mean, every possible thing that could be used for data breaches is something you're putting onto a into a dating site. So one of the things that we have found back, I think, roughly in 2011, 12, was several of the dating sites were creating secondary sites. So it wouldn't be the eHarmony site, it would be a secondary site. I don't mean to bag on them, they're not actually responsible for this, but just as a way of looking at it, it would be like eHarmony creating a secondary site. In fact, for a while, I think they had one called chemistry.com, and then using the secondary site to essentially steal data. And it certainly worked great for data mining. So, you get a lot of these companies that say, "Oh, we don't sell your data, we don't provide it to everyone else," on and on and on. Nonsense. That's where the money is. The money is not in you paying, your $19.95 a month. The real money for all of these companies is data and the data mining that comes with it.
I never had thought of that. You know, it's
Yeah.
interesting. You mentioned that medical facility at Bell and I-17. I used to get two shots once a month at that facility for a condition I had. I left them because their billing was so horrendous. They were an absolute organizational disaster. And so I left and go to where I'm at now. I guess maybe I should wait for the shoe to drop because I was at that exact facility you're talking about.
Yeah. And we found this, for example, in our investigation, and we talk about this directly in the book and we show the evidence of it. We did a bunch of work involving Dignity Health. Dignity Health is a huge healthcare provider. It's in California, it's in Arizona, it's in Nevada. It's mostly Western states, but it's in a lot of states. And what we found was a lot of infiltration into their system that was allowing, for fake employees to be put in, for payroll checks to be paid, for a lot of the insurance, for insurance policies, especially life insurance policies, to be bought, a lot of death and destruction of employees, leading to claims on the policies. And, probably, it's not huge, but certainly millions of dollars of loss for Dignity Health just in Arizona alone, just in Arizona and California alone. I mean, we even found, examples where there was one employee, but listed as working in two different locations in two different states, where the employee files were so screwed up as a result, because it was the same name, but different social security number, but same handwriting on the application for each, a policy obtained by one, and ultimately, receiving 5 times annual salary in a policy payoff when that person allegedly died.
Easy. Okay, now I want to bundle all this and take it in a direction. First of all, I had mentioned this to you right before we came on air. I've been told by a third party, not related to you, that in Arizona that we have lawyers practicing law that are doing so with the result of hacking into the Bar Association or academic credentials at a university.
Yeah, let me talk about that, because we first found this in California in 2011, where we found that there were lawyers, at least, who were on the bar rolls, who had a bar number, had a name, had usually an address and sometimes a phone number, who clearly didn't exist. And we were able, and I'll tell you about the phone call. The first phone call I had with the bar on this. I called the bar. I said, I need to talk to one of the investigators. They gave me one of the investigators. And I said, you've got at least one at this point, and probably many phantom lawyers on the bar rolls. And this is a problem. And the first question I got asked was, well, have any of their clients complained?
What does that matter?
I said, sure. I said, the phantom clients of the phantom lawyers are complaining all over the place. And they kind of believed me. And I said, do you not understand what I'm saying to you? It took almost 6 months before the State Bar of California actually understood what I was telling them, which was, you've got these names in the rolls who do not exist except on paper. What all of their uses are is not real clear, but they're being used for various things. In 2000, also in 2000, we didn't discover it until roughly about 2016, 17. But one of the other ones we found, which is talked about in the books, we talked about the Paul Tokeshi case, which is a lawyer listed in the bar's rolls in the state of California who literally doesn't exist. There is a photo for Mr. Tokeshi. There is no phone number. There is no business address. Instead, it simply has his name and has a address of a house. If you know where the Santa Anita racetrack is in California, it's actually the house is near there. It's in Santa Anita, California. The person literally does not exist. And if you actually try to trace back the person based on the credentials, you will find that there's never anything in their name. They allegedly went to UC Berkeley. There's no record of them at Berkeley. They allegedly went to Harvard University. There's no record of them there. In other words, and it's not just a record. You can't find somewhere that they lived. You can't find a phone that they had. You can't find a phone number or a phone service in their names. Nothing at all. But yet these credentials, which are all, of course, fake, they're all electronic, are then transported into the bar system, and voila, you have a lawyer. Now, you cannot have that without that being an inside job. That's not simply a hacking job, because bar numbers are sequential. They're not sequential alphabetically, but they're sequential to when you're admitted. You cannot simply stick somebody in after the fact. So if you have a sequential bar number, let's say the last three numbers of your bar number are 158. If there's a 159 and there's a 157, which there'll be, then somebody had to put that number in, the 158 number in real time. So it means that it has to be an inside job. So what you have is that you have at the State Bar of California, somebody inside who's got access to the system, whether they're physically in the bar or outside, sitting at a computer in a Starbucks, you don't know, but somebody who has inside access to the bar rolls in real time, who's able to put this in. We also have found that in Arizona, and in fact, we have found that this really originated not in California, but originated in Arizona. So in Arizona, you have a lot of this problem. We don't know the degree of how many because bar associations are there. Not only are they negligent in handling it, they won't even talk about it. You can bring this up to their attention all you want. They won't talk about it. They do not want to have conversations about the hacking into their systems at all. But the problem isn't just that. We posted recently about this and we've talked about it in the book. It doesn't just cover lawyers. It covers real estate agents. It covers real estate brokers. It certainly covers notaries. We believe it covers CPAs. We believe it covers mental health therapists, LMSWs, LCSWs, licensed clinical social workers. And we believe it very likely covers doctors. Now, it works on two different ways. One way, which we just talked about, is the phantom, somebody who's in the system where the name shows up, but the person doesn't exist at all. But we also have the problem the other way, where somebody receives credentials, is a real person, has credentials that they never earned. So in other words, I want to be a lawyer but I already am. So let's go with something else. I want to be a licensed clinical social worker in the state of Arizona. I obviously didn't go to school for that. I don't have a degree in that. So what do? I pay somebody to create a degree in that with coursework and everything at ASU. Then I create a graduate set of degrees, and then I create the license. And I put it all into the system, and I give you, for a pretty good chunk of money, I give you credentials. So what I wind up with, if this is done for me, for my benefit, is I wind up looking like I have an LCSW. And it's not hard. I was speaking the other day with a friend of mine named Martin Biel, who has worked at UCLA for years and is one of the people in charge of the registrar's office there. He and I have been friends for probably 30 years. And, one of the things I did when I first started finding this stuff is I called him, he's at UCLA. And I said, how easy would it be for me to say to you, give me a PhD? And he said, I could give you one in 10 minutes. And he said, unless somebody really, 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 really was thoroughly investigating you and went to professors and said, what did you think of the Saylor guy? And on and on and on. Nobody would ever figure out that the credentials were fake.
You know, this is right out of the show Suits on Netflix with Mike Ross. Let me tell you.
And the Suits thing is a really good example of this, which you brought up earlier. This is a great example of this because in Suits, look how easy it was. Now, look how easy it was to get caught too. Trying to pull this off, it can get difficult. And like I said, fortunately, we have caught some of these. But the fact of it is it's not that hard. It's I think for something like a lawyer, it is more difficult for obvious reasons. Because there's more public. One of the things that we find on the fake lawyers, of course, the fake lawyers can't really go to court. Phantom lawyers can't really go to court. So if you have a phantom lawyer, you're going to find that they're never on a document. They've never signed for anything. If they have, you're going to find fake signatures. Like on the Paul Tokeshi problem, he's now been, by the way, the Tokeshi persona has been suspended. There is no Paul Tokeshi who's capable of practicing law anymore in California because of our investigation. But if you looked at documents that Paul Tokeshi had signed, you had, I think, within over a 12-month period, you had five totally different signatures on the documents. So five totally different people signed documents as Paul Tokeshi. I mean, that was one way you could catch the problem. Now, unfortunately, one of those five who signed Paul Tokeshi documents turned out to be Brittany. So, it all came full circle because we could prove not only that the signatures were fake, but who was actually doing the signing. But for the people, for example, who have, LMSW licenses or real estate licenses, either a broker or as agent, that's really difficult because, what's going to go wrong? Do they get sued? Do they go up before a board? I mean, who's going to do the background check to look to see, do the professors ever know them? Because once it says that, you took classes at ASU, once it says you received your degree, once it says you received your graduate degree, who would you question? How would you go about figuring out that it wasn't real? If the system says it's real, people believe it's real. If you've got the parchment paper on the wall, people believe it's real.
Yeah, exactly. I want to ask you, because I had a source on this, and I believe the source was in a position to be correct in what they're telling me. And they have said a lot of what you said, but they took it a step further. They said, not only did it go through the professions you mentioned, but they said lawyers and future judges that make critical decisions that no reasonable judge would make?
Well, I would say this. The system by which I just wrote back to somebody on this yesterday who said, oh, we have great judges in Arizona and we have a system that, checks them out and a governor who appoints them. Absolute nonsense. And in fact, I have a chapter in section four of my book. I have a chapter on this, how specifically judges are chosen in Arizona and how corrupt that is. So you have two problems going on in Arizona. One is
Give
you
us an
have.
example. Can you give us an example how they're chosen?
Yeah, let me explain that, because it's totally different than most other states. A state like California, for example, you can get bad judges. I've had judges who just have no business being on the bench. And I can tell you from experience that every lawyer in, say, Los Angeles can tell you five or six judges on the bench who shouldn't be in Los Angeles County Superior Court, but are. And we will all agree on that, which is the big deal. We will all agree on that. We will all be able to say, yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. Regardless of whether they decided for us or decided against us, we would all agree on who those people are. The process in California, however, is pretty good. And what it does is I get these several times a year. The state bar will send me an evaluation form. They'll say the following two or three people have been recommended for judgeship. We think you've had some experience with them. Could you please, fill out this questionnaire, et cetera. So it starts with that. Are they, of course, in good standing with the bar? There's the, like what they give me is the peer review. There's a lot of that before you even get on a list to ever be considered. So there's a lot that goes into it in kind of an anonymous sort of way and sort of random, where people like me are picked, to be able to write up reports on what I think the person is. Do they have the right temperament? Do they have the knowledge? Do they have the ability? Do they have the communication skills? On and on and on. Before they even get onto a list that then goes to a committee at the state level. So it's not even local anymore. It's at the state level. And then at the state level, the committee looks over these folks, puts the rankings on them, figures out, who would be the best, for each general area, for the different counties. And then ultimately, I don't think the governors spend a lot of time on this, but governors generally have a specific person working for them who helps them make the decisions based on all of this. So there's a lot of screening process that goes on here. So it doesn't prevent bad judges, but it does keep down the corruption. In Arizona, it doesn't work that way. In Maricopa County, for example, there are five supervisorial districts. Of the five districts, each district has two people in each district who are on a committee that picks judges. One of those people is a lawyer. One of those people is a non-lawyer. So you have five non-lawyers and five lawyers, two from each supervisorial district, who basically select who they think should be a judge. And what happens is that, of course, is that the person in Gilbert, or the two people in Gilbert, will always approve of the two people who are in, say, Avondale Buckeye, who always approve of who's in Scottsdale, because you support my guy, I'll support your guy. So ultimately what happens is that there's no screening process. The only criteria is you have to at least be a member of the bar. You have to be a lawyer. Past that, there's no other screening process. If the committee of 10 says this person should be a judge, that's what goes to the governor's desk, and there's no further screening. So when an opening comes up, they just pick from that list. They pick, one, two, three, four from the list. That's it. So you can imagine the corruption that comes with this. So who's picked to be a judge? Well, sometimes that's somebody who's been at a major law firm, who has tried major cases, who's, one of life's ambitions has been to ultimately sit on the bench. So there are good judges, but oftentimes that's not who's picked. Who's picked are oftentimes sole practitioners who have, I have okay practices, but are making $150,000, $200,000 a year off their practice, who are easily controlled, who are going to make probably as much, if not more, money being a judge than they did as a lawyer. So you take out all the expenses, their actual income is going to actually increase by being a judge, not decrease. So it's not people who necessarily even started off wanting to be judges, but there are people who are then incentivized to be them. And so what happens is if you get, this local committee of two in that supervisorial district, the two people going to a particular lawyer and saying, hey, we'd really like you to be a judge. What do you think? And then that's when all the shenanigans begin, and that's what I talk about in the book, how they can be bribed, how they can be incentivized, how their practices can be sold off and they can pay, the debts are paid off, how they get favorable mortgages, all these different things to get them into offices. For sure, some of them are bribed outright. Just here's a bunch of money, go sit on the bench and wait for us. But a lot of them are incentivized, through a bribe system or a patronage system that gets them on the bench. And that, basically subjects them to a lot of, to a lot of things that obviously you don't want to have in judges. And so that's the basic problem. Now, that's just one problem. That's the Superior Court. The city court system is a total disaster. We got rid of this in the state of California because it was so corrupt. for the city court system, for Mesa, which is the most corrupt, for Gilbert, which is almost equally as corrupt, city of Phoenix, city of Chandler, et cetera, that all have their own city court system. Those judges are totally, completely picked by the city council. There is no washing them. They go and they make literally an application to the city council. City council interviews them. Sometimes we'll put them on the bench as a pro tem or a non-paid judge position several times to see how they do. And the criteria is very simple. How much money can you bring into the city by fines? The city court system is totally, completely dedicated to fines, taking your money. That's what they do. So what they try to do is they try to increase bails that they shouldn't increase. You'll try to give high bails that they shouldn't give. They will fine you excessive amounts for almost anything. And that's how the city makes its revenue. So basically, if you are a city court judge, you are a glorified bill collector. Now, that does not mean that there are not city court judges who take the job very seriously, who are dedicated to the profession of law, who are as neutral as anyone can be. But a lot of them are not. They are hired specifically to benefit the city. And that's what they do. And the fact is that if they don't do that, they are fired. So unlike judges of the Superior Court who are ultimately, they're appointed and then ultimately elected, which is usually about a 99.999% reelection rate, city court judges are hired and fired by city council. Now in Mesa, you know, we've tagged specific judges, Judge John Tapp, Judge Alicia Lawler, as being people who are specifically taking bribes, specifically red flagging files, specifically doing the bidding, if you will, of the city council. Which is equally corrupt. You know, one of the things we talk about in the book is you know, and we name names, as you know, as members, you know, from the mayor down to the city council members, to the city controller, to the city attorney, on and on and on. You know, people who are taking bribes, you know, usually through the mortgage system that we've talked about. And this leads to convictions of people who they don't like or don't want or undesirables or people they think they can get money out of. It is an entire corrupt system. Gilbert, the same way. We specifically call out the presiding judge of Gilbert, David Cutchin. David Cutchin and his family members, and especially on his wife's side of the family, are completely and totally completely involved in racketeering activities. We show the documents. We provide the documents in the book. As we talked about before in the book, you know, we have about 507 separate footnotes in the book. And those 507 footnotes provide you the documents that support each and everything we're saying. So if you go to the book's website, which is reporttothegovernor.com, and you go to the footnotes section, you can pull up the very documents. So when we say David Cutchin is on the take, we show you the actual documents to prove it. We show you the actual mortgage documents. We show you deed documents. We show you business documents. We show you who created those documents and why, et cetera, so that you can see the actual evidence, not just hear the story. So, you know, the book does contain about 100 or so plus documents, but we've got over 5,000 of them as footnoted documents on the website.
Let me take this in two directions simultaneously. One, the fake IDs we've talked about end up in voter fraud is what I've been told, another source, multiple sources. But what we're getting down here, the path of corrupt judges, I'm going to be very specific. The name of the judge has jumped out of my head, but it's irrelevant because it's everywhere. In one of Carrie Lake's cases, when she was trying to adjudicate the fact that she was a victim of bad election, fake election, it's a fact that 56% of the voting machines in Republican-dominant districts in Maricopa County failed upon opening. And I know because I had a relative and a neighbor affected by this. Okay, so that goes into court. That's accepted. It's proven. They demonstrated it. And yet the judge said, this is a free and fair election. Sorry, Carrie, you lose. This, to me, I was told by my source, he said, that's a judge you want to start with.
Well, let's put it this way. When the election occurred, obviously, and let me go through this a little bit slowly, because for people who are not in Arizona, they don't necessarily have a great handle on this. There's a couple of different things about Arizona. So let's go back to the voting thing real quick. The voting system in Arizona is about one third of the population voting by mail-in ballot and about two thirds showing up, give or take. Mm-hmm. That number has increased over the years in terms of the mail-in ballot. So we can talk about those problems in a second. In section four of my book, we tackled this very specifically of exactly what happened, exactly what went wrong, how it goes wrong, and how it, both in 2020 and in 2022, that led to results that were simply not true. And, you know, as you know, one of the things about me and the people I work with, you know, I don't do this alone. We are very, very, very bipartisan in our criticism. Republicans have benefited from the fraud for years and years and years. Democrats have benefited. So we go after everybody equally. We don't take a side on this one way or the other. Let's go through 22 because that's what you mentioned. What happened in 22 was roughly, it's not as high as 56%. It's actually more like this. At roughly, it's a precinct issue. At roughly 38% of the precincts in Maricopa County, the printer scanner machines failed. Now, the way voting works in Maricopa County, if you're in person, is that it works on optical scanning. So you essentially, you fill in, you know, a hole. Think of it like a Scantron form almost. You know, you fill in a hole. And when you fill in those holes next to the person's name that you want to vote for, that ultimately, that ballot, that piece of paper, you take over to a scanner and it goes to this machine and it scans that. And of course, obviously, you know, it counts the votes. Well, for a number of different reasons, which are a little complicated, maybe too long to get into here, the pieces of paper that were given out on the day of the election were not was not the correct size, and I mean by millimeters, not the correct size, not you know, like 8x10 versus, you know, 9x7.
I mean, I know what you mean.
Yeah, you're talking about small amounts of differences. Yeah, both in the thickness of the paper and the size of the paper, and so the ballots would not go through. So you could put this thing through the scanner. The scanner wasn't able to see it because the sizings didn't match up. Right. So, you know, your scanner's measuring, you know, 8.5x11 or 8x10, whatever the size was on this. It can't measure it because the size is slightly off. It can't measure the ballots. That's the problem. So on election day, after all the alleged testing that is supposed to go on, where they're supposed to obviously test all this long before, you know, a month before this ever happens, these things didn't go through. So it's roughly almost 40% of the precinct. The higher number that you're talking about is the number of machines, because at each precinct, there's multiple machines at each one. There's not just one scanner. This was an across the board problem. And to the degree that if you had three or four different scanners, for example, at a precinct, chances were all of them didn't work. So you had a total of roughly about 56% total, which is, and why is that number different? Because precincts, even though they tried to evenly divide precincts among voters, it's not. They know how many people are likely to show up at each different precinct. So there's more printers at this one versus this one versus this one because of what they anticipate the crowd being. So you have over 50% of the machines not working at 38% of the precincts. That's the problem you wind up with. And the bigger problem to me wasn't so much, there's two big problems with this. It wasn't so much that the votes didn't count going through. It's that there's a number of issues. One is that what's supposed to happen is that when that fails, that paper ballot, which, you know, obviously you have, you know, you're not holding this in your hand, it's not running, is supposed to go in something called box 3.
Yes.
That's just a designation that's given, you know, by the system here, by Maricopa County, for ballots that for some reason aren't working when they go through the system. It's literally what it is. So it's called box 3. The problem is that there's absolutely no chain of custody over box 3. So when box 3 gets picked up and taken over to run back election services, or the ballot to be hand counted. In other words, the idea is, all right, we're going to do it by hand. So this whole box we take over, this is all the ones that didn't work, which, by the way, is supposed to be about 20 ballots, not about 500 ballots. We're supposed to, you know, we'll take a look at it and we'll just, you know, do the totals by hand. Okay, that's fine. Except that there is absolutely no chain of custody. So once those ballots are picked up from the precinct, there's absolutely, nobody has any idea whatsoever what happens to them. There's not even really a check-in process over at Runback, which is the people who count the ballots, which is a whole other problem, that even tells you that the box actually got there. Or that confirms, and this was the bigger deal, that confirms that the number of ballots put into box 3 is the number being counted coming out of box 3. So there may be 500 ballots in the box 3 when it gets picked up. You don't know that 500 actually then got counted because there's no system by which that gets counted. So the problem is that if you want to tamper with an election, one way you can do it easily is take votes out of there. Now, the reason why this is such a big deal is that if this had kind of been across the board everywhere, you know, just randomly the 38%, that might not have been a big deal. If this was, you know, one day of voting, one day only, this might not have been as big a deal. The reason this was a huge deal in 2022 is because it doesn't work that way. The precincts involved were mostly Republican. By a very high number, and were Republican by a very large percentage, so that the number of votes that would have been in the box threes would have been very highly, probably two-thirds, one-third, give or take, Republican voting. Doesn't necessarily mean they voted for Kerry Lake or Abe Hamadeh, but certainly, you know, by sheer numbers, you know, by sheer polling data, you know, you can figure out about two-thirds of the votes were probably for Lake and for Hamadeh. and one third for Fontes or not Fontes that much, but for Hobbs and for Chris Mays. And so, you have the situation where who did this affect? It affected mostly Republicans. Second problem is the mail-in ballot problem that goes with this. There's another separate problem with mail-in ballots. But with mail-in ballots with this, the problem is that mail-in ballots are predominantly used in Arizona. It used to be more Republican because it was absentee. But now with mail-in, it's become more predominant, especially in Maricopa County, that Democrats use the mail-in ballot system more so than Republicans. So even at those few precincts that may have been leaning more Democrat, more of the votes coming in on election day would have been from Republican voters who didn't avail themselves to the mail-in system. So when you take a look at this overall, you've got tens of thousands of votes that are highly questionable in a highly questionable system, in a highly questionable machine breakdown, which happened to what? 38% of machines. I mean, consider this. How the hell almost 40%, 4 out of 10 machines, 2 out of 5, break down on the day of an election, all from the same exact problem? I mean, you've had a computer go out for sure, I'm sure, as does everybody else who's watching us or listening to us. They've had computers go out. But at the same time, does yours and your wife's and your kids' computers all go out at the same time? Yeah, the internet might go out. But when have you ever had a situation where everybody in the family who has a personal, has a laptop computer, had their computer go out at the same time from the same problem? No. In the absence of a virus, that's not possible.
No, I agree. And it wasn't a virus. And, you said right. You go after the bipartisan part of it. In 2020, I think it's mostly Democrats. But in 2022 in Arizona, it was Stephen Reicher and Bill Gates and the rest of the supervisors that I think facilitated this fraud. And their GOP, in fact, Gates, I don't know if you know this, Gates and Reicher actually took out a pack against America First candidates like Carrie Lake and Abe Amendola.
Yes.
And so you had Republicans working against Republicans.
Well, regardless of whether you even have Republicans working against
John,
Republicans,
we got about it.
You have on the face of it a gigantic conflict of interest going on.
Exactly.
And as we talked about before, Runbeck Election Services, which is the company that runs the election services for Maricopa County, is wholly owned by the Thoma family. Ben Thoma being the Speaker of the House. So you have the Speaker of the House.
He kicked out
the Speaker of the House for the state of Arizona, who owns the very system by which ballots are counted. I can't imagine anywhere where that would be considered legal, let alone ethical.
John, I got to stop this before they turn out the lights on us. Will you come back and do a part two? Because we're just beginning to merge some of these ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just say one other thing to you, because we got cut off on it originally when we went over to the election. But one of the things that my book does is it actually proves that Donald Trump actually won the state of Arizona in 2020. And we don't just say that. We show the mathematics of it. We show the voting fraud. We show how the voting was done. We show how the mail-in ballot system works. And one of the things that we do to talk about just for 1 second on the falsities of the mail-in ballot system, we actually got a hold of, for 2022, a number of the signatures off of mail-in ballots and the official signatures that they were supposedly compared to.
I'm aware.
And we can not only show that the signatures do not match at all, but we actually can tell you who some of those signatures, the phony signatures, belong to. That's how bad this is.
And John, we got to end this, but the corrupt judges said that was okay to have 2 seconds per signature verification. How do people get your book? And I'll be in touch with you to reschedule.
Yeah, the book is Report to the Governor. There's a paperback copy, which is not as huge as the hardcover copy. But you can get it at Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. And you can also get it by coming to the website, reportstothegovernor.com, all one word, reportstothegovernor.com. And I will actually autograph the book for you and send it off to you with a personal autograph from me. And we get those things out pretty quick. So we're actually, I think, right, even faster than Amazon these days. But any of those are just fine. And like I said, the reportsofgovernor.com site has a lot of other information, including videos and other presentational materials that we've done on the frauds that go on in Arizona.
Yeah, we need to merge these ideas because we went down a lot of avenues and there are some central themes that I know you know. I'll be in touch to reschedule. It won't be very long. You are an awesome source of information. Thanks, John.
Well, thank you, Dave. I always appreciate it. And anytime you want me, I'm happy to come back on.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.